Hello. I got swine flu in Canada back in November, and my chest has been collapsed ever since. I haven't got the flu now, so you don't need to vacate. I passed the contagion stage, I think, but I've had a rotten chest ever since. Apparently it attacks the respiratory system or something. I've got to say too, Pip, that, you know, it's not a mutual admiration society, but it's people like Pip that keep people on, like me, on the road, because, I mean, it's not easy being on the road, especially when you often leave your family behind, but the kind of stuff Pip's done just year in, year out, decade after decade, the level of the street, yeah, they're the real heroes, and some of us that are public speakers, we kind of get into the, you know, public attention a bit more. People like Pip are the unsung heroes of the faith, and I feel very honoured to be introduced by him. So give him a handful, isn't it? Even though it means a few minutes less for me to speak, my old friend Mark, I shouldn't say old friend, he's a young friend, I'm the old coot, but Martin Joseph, we first met, European Christian artist, I think, and he was a very... 1984? 82? Well, that'll be the first time I came to Greenbelt, because I sat with some leaders of Greenbelt in some place they said was the cultural centre of the world and ate pies and mushy peas. And this young man had been there the year before, I think, and he kind of was a bit more, well, more fundamentalist in those days, probably. So I had a bit of a, I liked this man. I met him and we talked about justice and stuff, and he was very young then. And I thought, this man is going to make his mark. I really felt when I first met him, even though I was on the sort of social justice thing and he wasn't at that stage, I thought, he's going to pass me one day. So I burst into tears, which pommies don't handle real easily with males. And I just burst into tears over my mushy peas in my passion to believe that this man should be made central at Greenbelt. And he's had a huge influence on me. There's times when I get discouraged and I just stick the headphones on and just listen for hours to his amazing music. And it so turns out that I believe of all the renditions of Starry, Starry Nights, his, I think, is the best I've heard. I think that's what he's going to sing. If he doesn't, he's going to sing a song about a very great black, wonderful artist who stood for justice, who I'm going to be talking about. Whichever he sings about, it's going to be about the kind of thing that we're looking at today. And Martin Joseph is a legend. You run out of words. You really do. This is a fantastic man. I'm proud to have him sing. Will you give him a big welcome as he comes through? I want to recommend a book to you. I don't even know if it's still in print. It's an extraordinary book entitled Speak Truth to Power. I've only ever seen one copy of it. I grabbed it straight away. It was about $60. It's only a matter of going to the movies three or four times, so I thought it was worth it. And if you want to really bathe in the topic of today, then it's a book really worth getting. I decided to start today with somebody who, in one sense, it may appear, was not so much making a dangerous statement of faith and justice when his art was well developed, but I believe he was. You know, there's a long history of the arts being at the forefront of speaking to power and of threatening power elites, and of the artists suffering enormous consequences, whether financial, whether social, whether physical, and even to the extent of losing their lives. And I, just an introduction today, there is something about the art of moral protest being in the arts. Visual art, music, performing arts, in all the fields of the arts, statements can be made that sometimes preachers can't make nearly as eloquently. I remember being in Amsterdam one time, and I think it was called Sarafina. At the time, I was very involved with those that were protesting against apartheid in South Africa. For some of you here, that's a distant memory, but for when I was young, that was an issue for us. I remember one day we decided we'd all go and protest in the city of Melbourne about Mandela's imprisonment, and it went longer than we thought, and I rang my dear wife and I said, "Honey, I'm going to be late home." She said, "Well, I figured on that, so I haven't cooked anything for you for tea. You'll have to go out." And I said, "That's all right." So I went to the local pancake parlour with a few of my mates on our Harleys, and actually I was more scruffy looking then than now. And a few weeks later, I got this letter, and it said, "Dear Mr. Smith, I was in the pancake parlour the other day when a bunch of bikers came in, and I was terrified. And I said to my friend, 'Do you think we should leave?' And she said, 'Oh, no, they're the good guys. If you look in their eyes, they've got love in their eyes, even though they look mean, they're okay.' So she said, 'I stayed.' She said, 'I thought about it.' She said, 'You know, my brother is a heroin addict, and my father left home, and it's been my whole family is chaos. And I went home after seeing you there, and I said to myself, if God can love someone as ugly as that man, he can love me. And I got down by my bed and asked Jesus to come into my life.'" So sometimes the message is better in unspoken visual form. But I look back into the story in the Bible. I see divine symbols, holy architecture, visual art, music, performing arts, the telling of stories. What if Nathan the prophet had gone with a moral philosophy lecture to David the king, whose main crime was not actually sexual? His main crime was an abuse of power. Everyone was out there fighting for him. He wasn't out leading the troops. He was at home ripping off someone else's wife, who wasn't in a position to resist in that culture. It was abuse of power. Most Christians get caught up in the fact that he was naughty and had sex with somebody else's wife. The real issue was abuse of power. And little Nathan comes in with an art form. We call it storytelling. And he tells the story of the farmer who only had the one little ewe lamb, and how the other guy that's got heaps of sheep comes and rips that lamb off. And he tells the story with such passion, such intensity, that David says, "Give me that sucker, I'll deal with him." And then he just says to him, "It's you." Or in the old authorized version, "Thou art the man." And David is poleaxed by the truth told in an old art form, storytelling. Now, he could have gone, given him a sermon about how it was morally wrong, but he gets him through story. I look at so much of the Bible is about storytelling. Jesus and his parables. Jeremiah, who goes to a potter's house and sees pottery that isn't quite right, so it has to get sort of chewed up and reshapen, and sees that as an image of what God does in the lives of his people. Jonah's whale of a story. The erotic poetry of Song of Songs, which, if you don't play the stupid game of trying to say that the Song of Songs is actually the Old and the New Testament related to each other like the medieval guys did, or like evangelicals do and say it's the relationship of Christ to the church, and you just take it for what it is, an erotic love poem that says that monogamous, faithful love is a beautiful thing, and that even the rich and powerful, like kings, won't be able to buy out the beautiful aspect of holistic love, including erotic love, in which in that story the imagery covers every tender, important part of the body. It's kind of a story that if you told it literally to your children as a bedtime story, they mightn't quite understand. The Song of Songs. Visions and dreams. Jacob and Joseph. Apocalyptic madness, such as John the Revelator, who one scholar said he thought he must have been on acid or speed when he wrote it, because it is so imaginatively off the wall. pagan images and poetry. St. Paul talking to a bunch of pagans and looking at the art. And first off, like a lot of Christians do when they see art, you know, get offended by it. Actually, my dear daughter is a real Facebook fanatic, and she loves getting stuck into all sorts of issues. And she's on about breastfeeding. So the other day she put in a very picture of her breastfeeding. And of course, some people objected. Others said, this is beautiful. You know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And I remember when I was a very much younger man and our first child arrived, a son. It's an image, not words. After all, he couldn't speak. He was only weeks old. But I have an image in my head that is like it was burnt into my brain. It's an image of little Paul suckling at mum's breast and his little fingers, pudgy little fingers, feeling her breast as he was drinking. And I remember sitting there and thinking, fellas, I wish I could spend half my life as a woman because I'll never understand what was going on there. I could sort of see it at a distance, but it was a visual image that drove home to me the relationship between a mother and a child, that no words, no poem, nothing could do. And a work of art of a picture like that can speak more than words. St. Paul, as he looked at the pagan artwork, he got upset because he was against paganism. He was a Jew, after all, in background, and they were against any form of idolatry, and here are all these idols. And first off, he doesn't get the message. But later on, when these guys say, what is this guy babbling on about? We don't know what he's talking about. A word used, I think, in the original language that speaks of a bird hopping around, picking up a piece here and picking up a piece there. That was used about people that would wander around picking up bits of philosophy from here and there but not being seriously committed. They said, what's this babbler going on about? Has he got a strange new sort of religion or something? And Paul realized he's not cutting the mustard, he's not communicating, so he reconsiders the art. And he sees that the idols are a statement of grace, not a statement just of idolatry. Because if you build idols, you're still looking for God. That's good news. And so he changes his whole tune through an art form, guides his sermon through that art form. And he says, hey, I can see that we've got something in common. We're all very religious. You're looking for God too, but you don't know his name. I know him. I can tell you who he is. And out of that great sermon on Mars Hill that's such an inspiration to missiologists, was born. Well, there's a lot more I can say about that. I just wanted to give that an introduction. I really do believe that art, theatre, I sometimes think Amos is close to the theatre of the absurd when he talks about horses are running and leaping around rugged rocks on a seacoast, being parallel to how on earth people that claim they know God can commit injustice. But we know in our history that rhetoric, poetry, literature, storytelling, art and drama has again and again threatened regimes, has caused people to feel solidarity in their battle against injustice. I wanted to start today with Van Gogh or Van Gogh or whichever way you want to say it. He began his art while he still was in a phase of faith. I don't know that he ever fully gave up faith. Of course, his life was a very mixed bag and his sexual behaviour wasn't what we'd want, and he appears to have been mentally a little bit deranged. But I sometimes wonder if the community of faith must bear the burden of responsibility for the sad latter half of this man's life. If you go online, you can actually bring down the first sermon he ever preached. Typical Dutch sermon, theologically quite precise, Trinitarian, all of that stuff. When Van Gogh started, of course, he grew up in a very religious background. He felt a call to the ministry. He was preaching before he was drawing pictures. But nevertheless, towards the end of that period, as he worked amongst the poor, images began to form in his mind. As he tried to minister to the poor which later on were to affect the shape of his art. He had an ambition to be a pastor and to preach the gospel. He became a missionary in a mining region of Belgium. His favourite verse of the Bible was, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach the gospel to the poor." Unfortunately, he didn't get sympathy from Dutch theologians. His favourite song was "Tell Me the Stories of Jesus." Of his two favourite books, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress was one of them. He tried to take Christianity as he saw it to its logical conclusion. He lived at one stage when he started pastoral work. He got thrown out of the theological seminary. He couldn't cut the mustard with that. He was too close to the heart of humanity and to God to deal with the dry theology of the Calvinist seminary. So he left there and went to a Bible college and trained to be a missionary. And when he went to be a missionary amongst the poor and the miners, he lived like his parishioners. He slept on straw in a little hut, and he dressed down rather than up. And it is said that sometimes he would have alcoholics who would vomit on him, and he would just embrace them and love them. He took seriously the words of that great statement of Jesus, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach the gospel to the poor." He was dismissed. Actually, one neighbour said they heard him often at night sobbing in the night. Of course, that probably in retrospect was said to be part of the fact that he was mentally deranged. It's more likely, since it was in the midst of his ministry to the poor, that it was the kind of weeping Jesus does for broken humanity. He cried at night over the sadness of the poor miners to whom he ministered. But they bumped him right off in the Christian church. You love this. This was their reason for dismissing him from ministry. That because he dressed down and because he kind of lived amongst these people as though he was one of them, and because he would allow himself to be vomited on, and because he wouldn't wear nice gear, this is what they said, that he was dismissed for undermining the dignity of the priesthood. Now, there's an artist who in the end suffered terribly at the hands of the church because he had a sense of full-on justice and compassion for human beings. He wished to be an artist in God's service. You know, I wonder if he'd been actually in the Celtic tradition, if he'd grown up in Ireland at the right time, whether in fact we never would have heard of Van Gogh as somebody that went mad. I mean, after all, I have a congregation where we've got people with all sorts of people that have suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. We've got a whole bunch of them in our church. In fact, we have a paranoid schizophrenic as a deacon, because we couldn't find any verse in the Bible that said you can't elect a paranoid schizophrenic as a deacon. If he gets a little bit too sleepy, we say you're taking too much medication. If he gets a little bit edgy, we say, "Hey, mate, are you taking your pills?" And we pray he'll get healed, and he hasn't been yet. But you know, the congregation nominated him to be a deacon because he was one of the most loving and serving and faithful and consistent people in the congregation. And he lives well in our church. And I believe many of those who suffer from mental illness, if they're embraced in compassion and love in communities of faith, can actually live not just normal lives, but extraordinarily useful lives. And I don't know quite how to feel, but we all know this, we're sick of hearing it, but old Luther's comment, "She may be a whore, but she's still my mother." The church, sometimes I feel, I mean, I believe in church. I even believe in institutional church. I'm not quite willing to go all the way with the postmoderns at present, because I think the church is meant to be not a voluntary association, but a holy institution where we love and serve one another. And I think sometimes the new thing goes too far. Because human beings anthropologically always create institutions to stabilize the culture. Without them, you end up with chaos. But as it turned out, this man unfortunately wasn't nurtured by a Celtic tradition. In the Celtic tradition, they actually ordained artists because they saw art as evangelistic, art as prophetic, art as pastoral. So you were ordained as a priest in the Celtic tradition when you were, as it were, maybe an apostolic artist who told the message through images, through drama, through ditties and through songs. I wonder whether Van Gogh would have, in the midst of what obviously was clinical depression or bipolar condition or whatever, I wonder if he lived in a community that said, oh, it is so good that you want to be like Jesus. Bless you for your example of downing your quality of life for the sake of others. Bless you for being willing to see the person, not the vomit, when they're sick on you. I wonder if he lived in a community that had said that to him, whether Van Gogh would have still produced his art, but would not have destroyed his life. And ultimately, in the pain and suffering and isolation he felt from the community, took his own life. This is what he said. He said he wanted to be an artist as well as a preacher. Quote, to try to understand the real significance of what the great artists, the serious masters, tell in their masterpieces that leads to God. One man writes it or tells it in a book, another tells it in a picture. Any of you have read The Return of the Prodigal Son by that late wonderful Catholic scholar, Henri Nguyen? Before he did that particular book, he got permission to sit and look at the original work of Rembrandt. I don't know if you've ever seen that painting. It's an amazing painting. It's so detailed. It's got all these faces. It's got faces with rejection, faces with loathing, faces with longing, faces with gladness of being received. All of those human emotions beautifully etched in faces that stare at you. You know, a photograph is not the true picture usually, but sometimes a work of art will put that face before you unblinkingly, keeping on making its statement. And so when you look at The Return of the Prodigal Son in Rembrandt's work of art, the faces look at you and you can see yourself. And so it was. I think if I remember rightly, he sat up all night, got permission to stay in the art gallery, and he just sat in a chair and stared into the beautiful detail of Rembrandt's picture, and out of that wrote his magnificent book, The Return of the Prodigal Son. The second person I want to mention today is a musician, Victor Jara. I don't know how you say it. I can't speak Spanish. If you're Spanish, forgive me. Is that right? Thank you. Victor Jara was a poverty-stricken youth. He went to work out on the farm with his dad, indentured-type labour. Didn't own the farm, just working for one of these rich farm owners in Latin America. He went out to work with his father in the fields at 6 years of age. His father was an alcoholic. In the end, the family broke up. His mother taught him how to play the guitar, and she died. And since they were really working on an old feudal system farm, he had nobody to look after him. There wasn't a social welfare system to care for him. And so the 3 years of trying to finish off his schooling, he didn't have a home. So he drifted from home to home of his friends. If you will, he was homeless with occasional friends. And that's how he survived till he finished that work. He went to seminary. He became a Redemptorist priest for 1 year. And then a year in the army. What a mixture. He then enrolled in a school of theatre at the University of Chile. Salvador Allende was popularly elected as somebody that wanted to bring justice across the whole of the Chilean culture. And as we all know, with the help of the CIA, Augusto Pinochet, in a coup, destroyed the work that Salvador Allende was beginning. This was a man who wrote songs about the poor. He was accused of being left-wing, and probably was, relatively speaking. But his songs are not songs so much of anger or violent revolution. They're songs that encapsulate the poverty of the common people of Chile. His music was more dangerous than preaching. The lyrics added to the words were indeed culturally transformational experiences. You know, the Westies understood that. I found in an old book not so long ago a statement from John and Charles Wesley. They said, in England, we have a basically theologically ignorant population. Nothing's changed. And they said, we'll change this. And the way we'll change it is we will write theology in good poetry and put it to popular songs. And you think of some of the words in the songs of Wesley, the power of those words. I mean, when I'm feeling a little bit slack, a little bit old, a little bit something, I find myself just muttering in my head, kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of my heart and let it to its source return. And I've lost the next bit. Come on, must be a Methodist here somewhere. With humble prayer and fervent praise. Well, at least the first part I can remember. Kindle a flame of sacred love on the mean altar of my heart. But you know, songs can grip us, can't they? I remember in the 60s, won't mean much to you here, but 60s and 70s, I remember as a young preacher breaking rank and going native, that I used to sing, I Shall Be Released. Now, I know it wasn't really what I was thinking, but that song, those words in the counterculture became more than just as a bloke in prison that's going to get out soon. It was a whole thing about the human spirit. I used to sit and sing, I Shall Be Released, and cry over that song, and it inspired me the way no sermon from anybody did. It fueled my fire in remarkable ways. Well, they imprisoned him for some days in a very dingy prison. And then they took him with a whole bunch of other people, very famous event, to the National Football Stadium, where they systematically tortured hundreds and hundreds of people. We're not too sure what happened. There are different stories. So what we do know is that his fingers played the guitar, and the compositions, the music with the words together in a glorious divine partnership had such effect upon the human soul. So they smashed his fingers. And according to one story, at least, they mocked him and smashed his fingers, and they put the guitar in his broken hands. One of the stories says they actually took his hands off. They cut his hands off before they killed him. But according to, I think, what's the most accepted story, they smashed his fingers, broke his fingers, put the guitar in his hand and mocked him and told him to play. So he played a song with his broken fingers and sang of the coming transformation and revolution that could bring justice to the people. Could you do that? I mean, there's something about the arts that not only does something to us, it does something to the artist. Any artists here that know that? And you know that somehow or other, the holy fire is lit in you as you create whatever it is. So they smashed his fingers, they mocked him, and he sang in defiance. And so much did that song, in the midst of the torture and suffering, get into the hearts of power that they went mad. They took a machine gun and pumped 44 bullets into his defenseless body to take him out in this life. It's not easy when you really confront power with the art of persuasion through music, through images, or whatever. Tomorrow I want to tell a story of how some paintings, how some drawings actually evoke the same kind of anger without words, without music, just drawings causing that kind of rage in the midst of political power. Third person I want to mention today is Diane Ortiz. I don't know if you've heard of Diane, but she has her story in this book I showed you. I want to read you some words from it. Diane was a Guatemalan contemplative, and I called her an artist because she was a teacher teaching little children. And any of you that are teachers know there's an art in teaching. It's the communication art. It's the verbal art. It's the imagery art. Children learn through images that are evoked through words. And so this Guatemalan contemplative, and I don't know if you can see it from here, but I want you to see her picture. I don't know whether you can see that. I want you to have that image. A slender, gentle little woman. Hear her story. I sat reading in the garden of the convent where I'd retreated to think about my options after receiving increasingly violent death threats. I heard a man's deep voice behind me. "Hello, my love," he said in Spanish. "We have some things to discuss." I turned to see the morning sunlight glinting off a gun held by a man who'd threatened me once before on the street. He and his partner forced me onto a bus, then into a police car where they blindfolded me. They came to a building and they led me down the stairs. They left me in a dark cell where I listened to the cries of a man and woman being tortured. When the men returned, they accused me of being a guerrilla and began interrogating me. Every answer I gave them, they burnt my back or my chest with cigarettes, and afterwards they gang-raped me repeatedly. I can't understand this stuff. This little woman, this frail little woman, but you see, power is very afraid of frail little women. Power doesn't care what you look like, how defenseless you are, how little you are. It only cares that a moral message dares to break into the immoral silence and speak. They gang raped her over and over. She had 110 cigarette burns on her back that still were scars when a court case in America years later tried to bring to justice those who had done it. She founded the Torture Abolition and Survivors Support Group International. When the court case where she sought to get some kind of justice because she knew that her torturers included people with clear American voices who then realized that they shouldn't do that, so they then spoke very poor Spanish. She knew there were agents that had to do with the American CIA that was involved in this brutality. So when she took it to court, she was mocked, she was threatened. They had taken her hands and put a hatchet in her hands and holding her so she couldn't escape, had hatcheted a woman to death with a hatchet in her hands and took photographs of it to say, "We will show these photographs that you killed this woman." When the court case came in 1995, General Gramario, or I think that's how you'd say it, was the Guatemala Minister of Defense who was doing courses at Harvard University at the time. Now, she got reparations of several million dollars, But to this day, the people who did this, and it must be known who did it, the CIA was involved, have never been brought to justice. This little woman still fights on for justice after all she's been through. It was a doctor who saw the 110 burn marks on her back and breast. They said it was self-inflicted. I don't know how on earth you self-inflict rape on yourself. But that was the kind of ridiculous defence that was given in the courts. Let me read you a bit more. The nightmare lived was nothing out of the ordinary. In 1989, under Guatemala's first civilian president in years, nearly 200 people were abducted. Unlike me, they disappeared, gone forever. The only uncommon element in my ordeal was that I survived, maybe because I was a US citizen and phone calls poured into Congress when I was reported missing. When she went to court, they threatened her. All sorts of threats came to her when she was in court. And she says that the doctor counted 111 burns on my back. In January 1990, the Guatemalan defense minister publicly announced that I was a lesbian and had staged my induction to cover up a tryst. The minister of the interior echoed this statement and then said he had heard it from the US embassy. According to a congressional aide, the political affairs officer of the US embassy, Lou Anselm, was indeed spreading this rumor. During that time, the United States was working arm in arm with the Guatemalan army to achieve a secret foreign policy objective, defeating the Guatemalan guerrillas. And my case was bad publicity for the army because I had mentioned the American boss. It was also bad publicity for the US government, whose overt foreign policy objectives in Guatemala were promoting democracy, stability, and respect for human rights. In the ambassador's words, my case could damage US interests. In a letter urging the State Department officials not to meet with me to take my testimony, the ambassador put it this way. If the department meets with her, pressure of all sorts of people and groups will build on the department to act on the information she provides. I'm afraid we're going to get cooked on this one. On her return, she says, I received intimidating phone calls and anonymous packages. This is when she came back to America. One of them contained a dead mouse wrapped in a Guatemalan flag. I suspect that the Guatemalan military intelligence agents or member of the US CIA were behind these attempts to intimidate me. It goes on and on. At one stage, this dear little lady was dumped in a pit, and the pit was full of tortured, broken, decapitated, and broken, stinking, rotting people. One can't understand this. How can you do that to a little woman like this? I'll tell you how. Because the art of speech, all forms of art that speak for justice, are so powerful in the face of power. The last one I want to mention today is a man who's had enormous impact on my life over the years. You've probably all heard of Paul Robeson, born in 1898, died in 1976. He was an athlete, a Shakespearean actor, a writer, a singer, a multilingual orator. He could speak Russian just about as well as English. He was a scholar, he was a lawyer, and he was and at one stage it said the only country in the world that didn't want him as a citizen was his own country. When he went to Columbia University, he played professional football to put together some money for his work there, for his studies. I think it was Rutgers University where he was the most outstanding player. The first day he went out to play football with their team, one of his own members came up alongside with the metal cleats and stomped on his hands when he went down on the ground and whispered in his ear, "Don't you ever forget who you are, nigger." He won the championship that year for the first time that college had ever won. And when they put out the photograph of all of the sportsmen in this team, they simply doctored the photograph. So his was the only face not in the photograph, though he was clearly the person that won the matches for them, because they wouldn't have a nigger in the photograph. Despite being one of the most internationally famous cultural figures of the 20th century, government and media persecution erased him from mainstream US culture. I still feel angry about that. I lived in America for the best part of 6 years, and it's almost as though there's this grand silence about one of the greatest black Americans that ever lived. It's as if even in the civil rights and black history, his name has been quietly removed. Of course, we all know about Showboat and his brilliant performance of Old Man River. I mean, that's his signature song. But on the other hand, many of us don't know that his portrayal of Othello is still seen as the high benchmark of Shakespearean acting for that part to this very day. He was the valedictorian at Rutgers University, which meant he had to give the lecture at the end of the year to all the students and the professors. And you imagine back then, it would have been in the 1920s. What would you do if you're a black student that was the best student in the university in those days? Well, he stood up and he gave the most stinging social justice message you could ever imagine. He never, ever cared about what happened to himself in his stand for justice. His playing in Othello, of course, is amazing, because here you've got the story of a black Moor who ends up with a sexual affair with a white woman. You can imagine in the days he was doing that, how that in itself was such a powerful statement. On one occasion, I think it was the Metropolitan Opera House, he refused to come on board to play unless his black brothers and sisters, if they could pay their way, could sit anywhere where the whites could sit. And he went on strike, and they couldn't do anything about it. They were in total chaos about it, and they shifted everything around, allowed the blacks to sit where they were not allowed to sit, because they couldn't do without his acting. His was the most outstanding acting in that particular performance. Anybody that goes, so as a matter of fact, my mate was going to sing a song about him in Wales. He had a love of miners. He saw the cruelty of the mining industry. The history of the mining industry is one of the most appalling histories of the abuse of money and power. And he loved the Welsh. So he had some marvellous time singing with Welsh miners. As far as I can work out, he is the first person that ever sang in the Sydney Opera House, because it wasn't quite finished. And his love for the workers, he was very much in supporting union movements. His love for the workers was such that he came to Sydney and he said, I want to give a free concert to the workers. And he put on a hard hat, climbed up amongst all the scaffolding and gave a free concert to the workers in the Sydney Opera House before it was finished. To this day, this man, who possibly is best known for singing the most tender, what we used to call Negro spirituals, I've got record after record of his and DVD after DVD, the most tender, moving renditions of black spiritual music you ever heard, sung really from the heart. Despite that, this man to this day has the largest FBI file of any artist in the history of the United States. Why did this happen? Why did they preserve such savagery for this magnificent performer? Well, you could talk a lot more about the things that he did. But why did they do this? Why is it that the black community has even by and large dismissed him? I believe it's because right from the start he dared to do something that we need to be done right now in this culture. Now, I'm going to take a risk today and say something that probably will some of you will think I'm crazy when I say this. But the thing that made them really angry was not just that he fought for black rights, but that he linked economics to the question of oppression of the black people. And he said it was all one deal, that it was about economics. It was about exploitation. And that they couldn't stand. Because, my dear friends, again and again, it's the powers of the marketplace where the most evil is invested. Why did they torture people in Guatemala? It's got to do with power elites. It's got to do with people who have agreements with massive companies in the United States. It's really got to do with money. I want to go so far as to say, I am convinced that the current deregulated capitalism in our Western world is essentially not just dysfunctional, but evil. Have I made myself plain, or I need to tell you what I really think? Because the way the markets work today is in utter violation of everything Jesus Christ taught. Beware of greed, which is the sin of idolatry. And the church around the world now, having taken the market model for its expansion, has actually sanctified greed because you can give a big offering to support the Lord's work if you live out the principles of aggressive self-interest and greed. I believe that's why he copped it. As I look at each one of these ones, maybe you could say that our first figure today is the exception to the rule. But the rest of the artists I've talked about today, in one way or another, they threaten a system that is about possessions, about wealth, and about power. And I tell you, my friends, if you're artists here today, Paul wrote some beautiful things to artists. He said it was morally incumbent upon all artists to speak for human justice. And I believe that to be true. If art is so incredibly powerful in its ability to move the hearts of human beings, then artists need to use that power, not for the sake of their self-aggrandizement or even financial survival, but for the sake of changing the world to what Jesus called the kingdom of God. Protest music, mime, jesting, street theatre, all of these things are always part of revitalization movements. I remember some years ago going to El Salvador and Guatemala with the Central American Missions Partners, which were the group that Bono went to the Central America with that had a huge effect on him years ago too. Before we went to the Mission District in San Francisco. And in some of the back streets of the Mission District, there were long sections, longer than the back of this tent, where people had done these magnificent artworks right along the fences, right along, showing the history of what had happened in Latin America. And I'll never forget one picture that showed two guys standing there with their M16s and the peasants pouring grain out into receptacles that had for export only, while that little boy was standing there with a look, absolutely stricken look on his face as he looked at one bean on his plate. That's symbolically true of what market forces have done in this world. And it's when art dares to speak against that kind of worldview that says things matter more than people, that invests in legal structures, unholy and godless behavior, that artists can be the most powerful and the most dangerous people in the community. Tomorrow I want to tell a story of an artist whose pictures couldn't be silenced and who caused great revolt amongst people of power in his day and age. I want to speak tomorrow of one of the earliest church fathers who had a brilliant speech ability and who stood up against the first great movement of prosperity doctrine in the Christian church in the 4th century. As we finish today, my time's almost up. I think the church right now is in the most dangerous state it has been in since the Reformation. I was listening to one of the top televangelist women not so long ago. You'd all know her. I won't tell you who she is. but her initials are JM. And this is what she said. She said, when you give to my ministry, you receive a divine receipt. And of course, the hint is that the largesse of the receipt is according to the largesse of your gift to the ministry. And when you need health or welfare, you go to Jesus and you cash in your receipt. So you can buy now from Jesus healing and prosperity. Can you imagine? I've got dozens of my friends that think she's a fantastic teacher. Can you imagine how Jesus would feel about that perversion? The woman that put the smallest coin in the realm in the offering plate, by that argument, couldn't get welfare, couldn't get healing, because the fat dudes up the way would get it for Jesus because they gave to the prosperity evangelists. How gross, how obscene does the church have to become before we wake up to ourselves? My prayer is that we might see some holy artists and musicians raise a voice against the corruption of the gospel in our day and age. The strange part is, in the past, the greatest opposition came from the ungodly, secular, political elements of the society. But if we give the whole gospel now, I've got a feeling we might not end up tortured like a little lady, but we sure end up with very strong opposition from the keepers of the cultus of religion, American culture, Christianity style, as much as from anybody, if we take a stand. Artists, those of you that are artists, for goodness sake, use your art to make a kingdom of God holistic statement about justice and mercy and the values of the kingdom. And those of us that are the mere lovers of art, buy the stuff, look at the stuff that says something that will bring about God's kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. Hope to see some of you again tomorrow. Bless you. Bye-bye.